wrote a Catholic Mass, and was it supposed to be performed all in one go? Find out just after the 1 o'clock news. But now, with a look ahead to Comic Relief, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The comedian Al Murray studied history at Oxford and combined starting his solo act with writing for Weekending and Spitting Image. He then worked with Frank Skinner and Harry Hill, for whom he supplied Harry's older brother, Alan. Perhaps his most familiar creation is The Pub Landlord. Indeed, it's prompted several best-selling books. The most recent is The Great British Pub Quiz. The more serious side of Al has been seen on BBC Four recently, a two-part series looking at the real Germany. This was sort of from Bach to Bauhaus, so a very different aspect of your life.
Yes, so quite a departure in terms of television for me, but something that I was asked to do, and the previous thing I'd filmed in Germany had been all about the Second World War, and I said to the commissioner, can we not mention the war with regards to Germany, Basil Fawlty style, and look at the country from that point of view. And it was a fascinating time.
Did you feel that you were going back to your studies of history and things here, that you want, you know, it was another side of your life that you wanted to explore?
Yes, very much so. I mean, when I got to Oxford, there was a fantastic review scene and some brilliant, interesting people doing comedy. And I have to admit, history took a bit of a back seat, and largely because I was compelled to do it. So now I don't have to do study history. I'm much more interested in it. So it was fascinating to come to things afresh. And I really knew very little about Germany. I had been exposed to its music, really, and then Germany as the 20th century British idea of Germany, which is the Second World War and the Nazis. So to look beyond that and before it was fascinating.
Well, we'll come on to that and the music a little bit later on. How did you feel that your particular sort of character developed as a comedian? Because, I mean, it's a very definite one, and it's been incredibly successful.
Well, it was an accident. I was working with Harry Hill, and we had a show that we took to Edinburgh. When I was playing in the band that we had this little band called the Pub Band, and I was playing the drums and Harry was singing, and we had this show that had no way of being glued together. There was no comparing central thing for it. So on the day we opened, I said, well, how about I be a pub landlord? And he said, all right then, because he was worried about his stuff. And on I went, and it worked. And then it sort of emerged from, I mean, what I like about it is emerged from an accident, and it emerged from the sort of essential heat of having to go on stage and make it deliver, rather than a sort of more intellectual approach of figuring something out and then taking it on stage.
And like all the best things in life, you've clearly had fun with it.
Oh, yeah. It's been terrific fun. And it's 15, 16 years ago I first started doing him. He's still generating material, which I never imagined would happen.
And presumably his list would be rather different from yours.
Oh, his would be, I think, mainly patriotic themes and, yes, martial music, possibly.
Well, let's start with your first piece, which is quite a familiar one, but an incredibly arresting one.
I grew up with my father listening to Radio 3. There was no pop music in the house I grew up in, except maybe a Rolf Harris record or something. And Dad is majorly into Handel, Bach, I think sort of pre-classical music, really, strictly speaking. And we listened to a lot of recorder music and stuff like that. And the house would shake to the sound of something like Zadok the Priest, because the grandeur of this music and its simplicity and its economy as well. It's the what's fabulous about Zadok the Priest is that when the choir comes in, it's like a bomb of colour going off. It's the most extraordinary thing. And I
think Handel must have known it would make a terrific effect, but he could never have known the universal appeal it would have.
Well, I don't know. I think he knew it's theatrical music, which I think is fascinating, and his tunes turn up in the Beggar's Opera and stuff like that, so I think he knew that drama was a very important part of I mean, because it's supposedly a devotional piece of music, but it's way too dramatic for that, I think.
But it's a bit like what you do, in a sense. It's about timing, isn't it? Keeps you waiting for that.
Oh, yes. It's the anticipation, yeah. And what I love about this piece of music is its inevitability. And I always think the choir's going to come in an eight-bar cycle earlier than it does. He really holds off. It's masterful.
It's also suitably regal, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. If the king doesn't live forever after that, he never will he? It's extraordinary.
One of the Handel coronation anthems, Zadok the Priest, the choir of King's College, Cambridge, with the Academy of Ancient Music, directed by Stephen Clebury. Now, Al Murray, you actually played instruments, percussion instruments.
Yes, yeah, I did. I was fantastically lucky, actually. I went to Bedford School, and we were exposed to a great deal of music. I mean, a lot of it being chivvied into choral societies and things, but I played percussion and played a lot of timpani, actually, and stuff, and then ended up in the Bedfordshire Youth Orchestra, which was a fantastic experience. And
you still use all of that because you do your own music.
Yeah, I still play and I still write music. And for any programmes I do, I'll generate the music myself and record it at home. But much more down the sort of rock music thing now. But we ended up playing in the Albert Hall. We went to Paris. We went to Barcelona. We had the most fantastic opportunity for a musical education in Bedford. It was amazing.
It just shows how terribly important it is that music is taught in schools, so that everybody has the opportunity to...
Well, I undeniably. And of course, it's the sort of thing that when you're going through it, you take for granted a little. But I would have probably played music every day of the week at school by the time I was in the sixth form, because there was a dance band, there was a little Dixie band, we had a proper school band, which was a, you know, woodwinds and brass thing, and two orchestras. And I would have probably been to a rehearsal every day of the week and grew up being exposed to all this stuff. And we'd mash our way through something like Beethoven's Fifth once a year, and I can't vouch for the results. But the youth orchestra was really fantastic. And Michael Rose, who was the director of music in Bedford at the time, was a very inspiring figure and drove the orchestra and drove the scene. And it was a fantastic thing. I mean, for your holidays, to go to Paris and play music in Paris was the most extraordinary thing.
The thing about percussion is that you sometimes have to wait quite a long time before doing anything.
Oh yes. I mean, you'd open the score and whole movements would be tacit, and you'd think, oh well, what are we going to do? And also, you're a bit of a removals man as well. And we spent a great deal of our time backing vans into stage docks and unloading timpani and that sort of thing.
Porterages.
Yeah. Well, yes, if you want. There was one concert in Spain where the repertoire that night was all tacit, so the percussion spent the evening in the pub, but there we are.
I've often wondered how players do that, you know, how they manage to come back and play when they've had so much.
Well, I don't know. I remember we played Ravel's Bolero, and a friend and I were given the snare drum part, and the percussion tutors, mentors, had us playing, I think, 24 bars each and then taking turns as we got louder and louder. And the rest of the percussion section don't come in until the last, I think, 16 bars or so. So the moment we started, they were out the door of Bedford Corn Exchange into the pub next door, and they had a stopwatch going, and they reappeared through the side door of the stage with four bars to go, picked up the cymbals and sat at the timps, and off they went. It was hilarious.
And is this next piece a product of that period?
Yes, we played Scheherazade, Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade, in Paris, and we played a show at the Georges V Hotel, a concert, rather. I call them gigs now and shows, and it was a concert. It was some youth exchange thing. So we had a big dinner and then proceeded to play. And because they were over 18, some people had some wine and some people hadn't. So it wasn't our best performance. But I remember I was playing the triangle in this. And the second movement, I think a large stretch of it's in a 3/8 metre. And it's counted in one. So it's 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, went like that. Going
by like a train.
Yeah, goes a lick. I remember at the first rehearsal, not really having paid attention particularly, and thinking that it was 1, 2, 3, it was going like that rather than 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and being possibly 180 bars adrift, not coming in the right place. And I remember Michael stopping the orchestra and saying, you do know where you are? And I said, I'm terribly sorry, I have absolutely no idea. So he backed the orchestra up and we started again, and I never counted that wrong again, because the bars would zoom past.
Well, let's hear part of the second movement from Scheherazade, Opus 35, by Rimsky-Korsakov.
Thank you.
takes you back to those days.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I think I was wrong. I think I was playing cymbals. Judging by the shape of the music, I remember definitely some of those sweaty palm moments of picking up the cymbals and...
Well, that's even worse, really, because of the triangle. If you come in, you might not do too much damage. But...
Well, I don't know. A triangle in the wrong place can cut through things.
Yes, quite true. We heard music from the second movement of the symphonic suite Scheherazade, Opus 35, by Rimsky-Korsakov, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Al Murray, are you interested in a wide section of music? I mean, do you like if you play in a band and things, you must be. Do you like contemporary music?
Yeah, I think so. I grew up in a house full of classical music, and I only really remember my father once sitting down to listen to anything like the Beatles. I remember the day John Lennon died, him coming home from work early and putting on Abbey Road, and but that was the only time I ever saw him listen to that sort of music. So we very much grew up in a classical environment, but I'd sort of go through periods of loving jazz music and finding myself very much focused on artists like Miles Davis. I'm an enormous fan of, because the trumpets remained the same regardless of the background. His settings change, but his essential voice remains the same. And people who can do that, I find absolutely fascinating. But yes, all sorts of music, really. And I play in a little rock band now that's characterised really by the general midlife crisis of its members, which is good fun. But the thing that fascinates me about music is its ability to get past your defences and to inhabit you emotionally and inform you emotionally. And just listening to that again, those motifs that keep coming round, and there are the French horn in that. A dear friend of mine played French horn, and I remember the melancholy of those notes, but also his absolute panic that he was going to be able to produce the sound from the horn. And the relationship between a musician and their instrument is a thing that fascinates me as well, you know, because I have a shaky one with the drums. And that music is beyond writing. You know, I write jokes, I try and perform the jokes well and that sort of thing. But music's on a different level for me, I think.
Actually, talking of that, do you tend to write all of the stuff or do you improvise a lot?
For a stage show, two-thirds will be written and then a third will be improvised given what's in front of me. But some nights it's half improvised, depending on what sort of materials I get out of the audience in front of me and the night. Because I want it to be special, every night to be different, every night special. And also I don't want to get bored, which is the other thing. If you're doing 120 shows a year of what's essentially the same show, you could get
bored. You have
bored.
Heard all the jokes yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know where their weak points are and which one's better than others and all that sort of thing. So the talking to the audience and making it special. I think stand-up comedy has that ability that there is no fourth wall, there's no need for it. And in fact, the thing that's exciting about it is you can ask a question of an audience member and it will change the course of the evening. And that's the thing it's got that no other art form has, I think. Even jazz, where the improvised, it's not to do with the audience necessarily.
The next music, which is why I brought up contemporary figures, is a synthesis, really, of three musicians, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm an enormous David Bowie fan, and he, for me, is rather like Miles Davis in the sense that the voice essentially remains the same and the musical scenery around it or behind it might change, but his essential voice has stayed constant. And this is the Low Symphony, which is Philip Glass's adaptation of Bowie and Eno's work from the album Low. And the second side of, I mean, it still had sides, this record. The second side of this album was all instrumental and Glass took this music. And they recorded Low in Berlin, at the Hansa Studio in Berlin, which was next to the Berlin Wall. So the music, to me, is extremely evocative of what I imagine a Cold War alienated place would be like, with East Germany just over the wall. And what Glass did with it, I think, is fascinating, because it even more brings out the melancholy and having been to Berlin since and the wall's gone, I don't know how this music would now stand up, perhaps, but it's fascinating and an interesting thing for Glass to have done.
Thank you.
funny how music brings back certain things. As we were listening to that, and you'd mentioned about Berlin, and I was recalling going to that, I don't know if you saw this little museum by Checkpoint Charlie, which is very touching because it's got mementos of the people that tried to get across the wall and didn't.
Yeah.
And the various devices they used. And I was just thinking when you were talking about how it has a kind of sadness to it. Really.
Yes, it does. It's a melancholic music. Mm. I'm going to Berlin next weekend, mainly because the only times I've ever been there have been with a film crew. And so you don't get to go to the... If you're not filming at the museum at Checkpoint Charlie, you don't get to go there. So,
and if you are, you go nowhere else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so... I'm well up on where Hitler's bunker it was, but I've not done that particular bit of Berlin's history, so I'm very much looking forward to that. It's very evocative, that music, of the what must have been the melancholy of the place. Now it seems like it's a vibrant and bustling city. It's changed.
Subterraneans from Philip Glass's Low Symphony. We heard the Brooklyn Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Dennis Russell Davis. Now, another piece that... Al Murray, I imagine you must have taken part in.
Yes, we had a choral society that we were press ganged into, and I think I definitely sang in this once, and then I know I certainly played percussion with the youth orchestra in this piece, in Carmina Burana, which of course has now suffered from the ghastly overplaying via the X Factor, and everyone knows it as sort of O4 tuna and this portentous music, and they don't know about the rest of the piece. And we played this at the Albert Hall, and this part I have very, very clear memories of, in that we had a massive array of percussion, because it's fantastic 20th century music, five timpanis, xylophones, cymbals, woodblocks, all sorts of stuff. And we got to the end of this particular part, which is very frenetic, and I remember some sleigh bells fell off the percussion stand just as this movement ended, and it goes wham, it ends with cymbals and bass drums going, and then this thing fell off, tinkle. The conductor looked, the whole of the Royal Albert Hall must have heard. And it's one of those moments where you think, the entire world is looking at me. I've done something terribly wrong, and there's nothing I can do about it. And I remember because sleigh bells, because they're the little steel ball and the ball rolls around, will make a noise if you look at them. One of the other lads bending over and putting his hand into this leather strap of sleigh bells, stretching it and picking them up and putting them back on the on the stand without making a sound. And we didn't know whether to laugh or cry. And it was just, and while other people might think of this music as a sort of fabulous story of fortune and drinking and monks and misbehaviour, I see it as this ghastly moment where we were suddenly all rather landed in it.
Thank you.
Fortunae Plango Vulnera, music from the first part of Karl Orff's Carmina Burana. We heard the St Clement Danes Grammar School Boys Choir and the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by André Previn and without sleigh bells interposing.
The agony has returned, I have to say.
Now, I know that your pub landlord is quintessentially English, but I don't think that would necessarily meant he was a lover of Elgar.
I don't think he would have crossed his path, apart from...
Well, Land of Hope and Glory.
Apart from Land of Hope and Glory, but I think the pub landlord's attitude to that must be a folk song or something. To be honest, he's a Queen fan and likes Queen and only Queen, and nothing else has ever really crossed his path. That and the National Anthem, which... he has a neat explanation of why it demonstrates that the British, it's essentially a life support system for the Queen, so that every time someone sings it, God checks up on the Queen and makes sure she's all right, which is the idea. But no, he wouldn't have been exposed to Elgar other than Land of Hope and Glory, I think.
But you like Elgar.
Yes, I do. And again, this is my proper exposure to Elgar, is we did the Enigma Variations in the Youth Orchestra. And Nimrod, of course, is the bit everyone remembers, the movement that seems to sum up some kind of English melancholy or something. But my memory of this is very much to do with a day when we were rehearsing. And we were rehearsing in an education college in Bedford. And our conductor stood up and said, "I've some bad news. You may remember this violinist who played with us last year. He was killed yesterday in an accident on a holiday job." And everyone... was aghast, and then we played Nimrod, and it was the most extraordinary moment with an entire orchestra playing this piece of music, which is incredibly moving, having heard this terrible news, and everyone was crying, and so this music forever is wired into this extremely raw emotional moment, and it really is what I was saying earlier about music, is that music can get past absolutely all of your defences and touch you emotionally in a way I think other things often can't.
And on top of that story, the way it starts so quietly and gently.
Yeah, yeah.
Foreboding.
Yeah, so we had this very odd moment of... And a sound that will always stay with me is the sound of an orchestra picking up its instruments. There's that moment where you hear the fiddle players getting ready to play, and... So there's that sound, and then the orchestra starting very quietly. And for me, Nimrod is about that build and this, to be honest, sort of tidal wave of emotion that went through the room. And it was a peculiar moment.
It is the sort of still beating heart of the piece, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's the very much the centrepiece of it. It's an extraordinary piece of music, that I have to say. Yeah.
Nimrod from the Enigma Variations, Opus 36 by Elgar, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. And we normally associate him with Bach and early music, so quite interesting to hear him doing the big sweep of Elgar.
Well, that was beautiful.
And it is, in fact, Bach we come next to. I mean, presumably you did quite a lot of exploring Bach when you were doing your German
studies. Well, yes, we spent a long time in Leipzig. We spent several days in Leipzig. Really, from the point of view that Leipzig was at one point very much the musical centre of Germany. And, of course, Bach was the choirmaster of this choir, the Thomannerchor, which is a choir school. And he was choirmaster then, when it was a mere 500 years old and had been going for so long. And we visited the Thomannerchor, which is a scholarship school in Leipzig, a chorister school, and we had the most extraordinary experience there. And they let me sit in rehearsal and sort of mumble along with them, which was an incredible privilege. It's a boarding school. They're in houses called Stuben, and the heads of the houses have to look after the music. So we didn't make the programme, but we spent quite a long time talking to one of the boys whose job is to look after the manuscript, you know, the music. So he had Bach folio stuff in his study. It was just the most extraordinary place. And the line of tradition that you felt right the way through, back to Bach and beyond, was amazing. We came in at lunchtime and they stood up and sang Grace in their refectory. And that music and Bach's ethos with that choir and that they still have is to sing to the glory of God. And I'm an atheist, but the glory of God was being sung and right there in front of me before they ate their lunch. It was extraordinary.
And what do you think, and especially in this piece, characterises Bach for you? What makes him so special?
Well, I think the thing is there are rarely harmonic surprises. In a way, he's working with the plainest of materials in lots of ways. It's before orchestras got sort of flashy and complex, and it's before tritones became common and all that sort of thing. Yet it's incredibly direct. The logic of the music, I think, is very, very interesting. And I don't know, perfect is possibly a word.
And he does imply friction in the harmony, doesn't he? You know, when he has those suspensions where two notes rub against each other before the lower one resolves.
Yeah, but the lower one resolves is what will happen. And it's almost as though Bach's music is telling you that through religion your life will resolve, or there is resolution. And I think that's a fascinating thing to hear in music.
Oh,
Quite fascinating hearing that, Al Murray, after Zadok the priest, because there it seemed to be saying, the king is my god, and here, Gott ist mein König.
Gott ist mein König, yes, God's my king.
That chorale was from Gott ist mein König, the cantata BWV 71 by Bach. The Thomanerchor, Leipzig, and the Gewandhaus Orchestra, Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Thoma. There's another series you've been involved in, which I think, Al, has prompted your final choice, a World War II one.
Yes, well, I made a programme several years ago about the last year of the Second World War, which was called Road to Berlin, where we travelled from the beaches of Normandy to Berlin via the sort of main scenes of drama and pivotal points. And I very much have grown up fascinated by the Second World War as the sort of the event that's landed us largely where we are now. And this piece of music is, well, the Dam Busters March. A friend of mine used to joke, a chap Richard Thomas, who wrote Jerry Springer, the opera, he always used to joke that classical composers had been born 100 years before movies, and so they'd been thwarted in their aims and ambitions. And Coates obviously doesn't fall into that category. And this is a piece of music that, again, my childhood was about a lot of music and a lot of sort of classic films, and the Dam Busters falls very much squarely into this. And it's essentially, as a historic film goes, it's pretty accurate. The story is accurately told. And this music is so evocative. I think the pub landlord would know this, though he probably wouldn't know quite where from.
Thank you. It does bring back the faces of all those British actors in those World War II movies.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And I remember rather ashamed to be... I was almost more upset by the Labrador being run over. Do you remember?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. No, it's terribly evocative, that, isn't it? And sort of innocent in a way, too.
Funnily enough, conducted there by that sort of wonderfully, quintessentially English person, Sir Adrian Bolt. You know, he had big white moustache. And I remember him once... conducting a march rather like that and actually twiddling the end of the moustache, you know, just...
Fantastic.
So actually that was just winding the music up in the right direction. We heard Eric Coates' Dambusters March, Sir Adrian Bolt conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra, and actually you're going to be... they're going to be accompanying you soon.
Yes, I'm for Comic Relief, which is imminent... there's a kazoo orchestra being formed, and I've been roped into doing that, which I think's going to be rather good fun, with the BBC Concert Orchestra. I don't know what we're doing yet.
I would love to see Sir Adrian conducting that. But I'm afraid that is no longer possible. Well, Al Murray, thanks so much for sharing your musical passions with us. And indeed, they aren't what we might have supposed from the Pablo Award.
Well, thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Al Murray was talking to Michael Barclay, and as Al mentioned, he'll be taking part in Radio 3's Big Red Nose Show, which is tomorrow evening, 14th of March, at the Royal Albert Hall. It's an evening of classical music and comedy featuring the BBC Concert Orchestra with Nicola Benedetti, Julian Lloyd-Webber, Sue Perkins, Marcus Brigstocke, Tim Vine, and a host of other comedians. And that list includes Al Murray, who will be buzzing his way through the Dambusters March on a kazoo. Now, if you'd like more information about this, do go to the Radio 3 website. The concert will be broadcast here on BBC Radio 3 this coming Friday evening, the 18th of March. But the event itself is tomorrow evening. And the broadcast on Friday is at 7 o'clock. Well, next week on Private Passions, Michael Barclay goes to Herefordshire to meet the horticulturalist and Gardener's World presenter Monty Don. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Sarah Cropper.
Free your imagination. Books on the BBC.
Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen.
If anything, Pride and Prejudice made me realise how universal some things are across cultures.
Primo Levi's The Wrench.
I hugged the wrench to me for years, and then in my very first public lecture, I decided to share it.
George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia.
How extraordinary it would have been if one day the door of my cell had opened and the guard had flung in a copy of Orwell's book.
For BBC Radio 3, five prominent personalities reflect on the books that changed their lives.
It is still capable of changing people, as it changed me.
Weeknights next week at 11 o'clock and on BBC iPlayer at bbc.co.uk/radio3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock. Time for the news from Ian Skelly.
The Japanese Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, has described Friday's earthquake and tsunami as the worst crisis the country has faced since the Second World War. Around 1,400 people are confirmed to have died, and 10,000 more are unaccounted for. Officials are warning that there could be a further explosion at a nuclear reactor that was damaged in the quake. About 200,000 people have been moved from the area surrounding the plant in Fukushima as a precaution. Reports from Libya suggest rebels are withdrawing from the eastern town of Brega amid a heavy bombardment from Colonel Gaddafi's forces. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is flying to Paris to meet Libyan opposition leaders and express support for their cause. In Bahrain, riot police have fired tear gas to try to disperse thousands of anti-government protesters who are blocking the main road to the financial district in the capital Manama. There have been clashes outside a university and in Pearl Square, where the demonstrations began last month. The Liberal Democrat leader, Nick Clegg, has told his party's spring conference in Sheffield that he hasn't changed one bit since going into coalition with the Conservatives. In a speech in the past hour, he told delegates that the Lib Dems were neither on the left nor the right, but were on the side of ordinary people who were wanting to get on. More than 40 performers from television, film and theatre are warning that government spending cuts will lead to a crisis in the arts. Stars, including the actors Simon Callow and Kenneth Branagh, and the director Mike Lee, say that the abolition of the UK Film Council and the financial pressures faced by the Arts Councils and the BBC have created the biggest threat to the industry in decades. The Culture Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, insists the arts will fare better than many other public services. And the weather for this afternoon, there'll be rain for eastern England, parts of Northern Ireland and Northern Scotland, with further snow over the Grampians and Highlands. Many western areas will have a sunny afternoon. Tonight, England and Wales will be mostly dry, clear and frosty, but rain and snow will continue in the north. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2.5 minutes past one.
And time to join Catherine Bott and the Early Music Show to explore a musical enigma heralded as the greatest artwork of all times and all people.
On April the 10th, 1859, a choral society in Leipzig, the Riedelverein, gave the probable premiere of a large-scale composition by Johann Sebastian Bach. Parts of it had been sung and played before, but this is thought to have been the first performance of the whole thing, more than a century after Bach's death. The publisher of the first edition had proclaimed it as the greatest work of art of all times and all nations, and many people would agree with that assessment today. But it's still a musical and liturgical enigma. Why did a pious Protestant write a Catholic Mass? Was it meant to be performed all in one go? Welcome to the story of Bach's Mass in B minor. To begin the story of this pinnacle of Christian music, we have to go back around 125 years from that putative premiere to 1733 and the death of Augustus II, King of Poland and Elector of Saxony. Augustus was fondly nicknamed the Strong. He was a big, bear-like man, a discerning patron of the arts and sponsor of the earliest makers of porcelain. He also had a strong attachment to numerous well-born mistresses who bore him an unfeasibly large number of children on the wrong side of the blanket. When his strength finally gave out in 1733, his one legitimate child, unimaginatively but sensibly styled Augustus III, decreed 5 months of mourning and the suspension of all public music-making. How did this affect Bach in Leipzig? Obviously, his duties as cantor of St. Thomas's Church continued, but his activities as director of the city's prestigious civic music-making body, the Collegium Musicum, were curtailed. And he was feeling rather jaded after almost a decade serving the people of Leipzig. 3 years earlier, he'd written to a friend complaining about his job. "The post is by no means so lucrative as it was described to me. The place is very expensive. The authorities are little interested in music. So that I must live amid almost continual vexation, envy, and persecution." He needed a new source of income, a court appointment. When a new regime takes hold, the first thing for a canny composer to do is to get in with it right away. Augustus, unlike his Protestant mother, but like his father, was a devout Catholic. So Bach used this five-month layoff to work on the composition of a missa, or Latin Mass, the only major type of sacred music common to both the Lutheran and Roman Catholic rites. He set the Kyrie and the Gloria of the Mass ordinary and dedicated them to the new king, taking him a copy in person, along with a petition to be granted some sort of post at court. It took 3 years, but Bach was eventually made court composer in 1736. The Missa was first performed in 1733 during the festival of the Oath of Allegiance to Augustus III. It consisted of settings of the Kyrie and Gloria for five-part choir and an orchestra with trumpets and kettledrums that now comprise the first part of the Mass in B minor.